It is Friday, February 9th, and I'm Josh Newton. Welcome to the I'm Josh Newton show, where it is all about putting your potential into practice. Today, we're going to jump into part two of our interview with Doug Wilson. If you haven't listened to the first part of this interview, I highly encourage you to go back and listen to that in episode 39. In that episode, we explore some of Doug's background. We talk about why he doesn't like to use the word human resources or human capital to describe the people space, how he's running a thought studio, and why he thought being transferred to the people side of a business was a negative versus a positive. In this second segment here, we're going to talk about something that I thought was really interesting because it's not a topic that Doug and I have touched on in the past, and it's an idea that he's exploring around intergenerational friendships.
Actually, this leads into something that I have a lot of questions about, or I'm really curious about, because it's something we haven't talked about a good bit, but it sounds like it is something that you're really passionate about, and it's this idea of intergenerational friendships. So speaking of generations either not understanding each other or maybe even pointing the fingers at each other, talk a little bit about that space. What are you doing in that? Why has that become something that you're really interested in or you've started to explore?
Well, that's another really good question because it was unexpected. So, you know, in the venture space and in the thought and conversation studio, I end up working with a lot of boards, public companies, in the thought and conversation space. The venture is a lot of in the startup space, but it's really more co-investing with others. So I only really get involved if I have a particular expertise or a connection point that they need. But out of all of that, what began to emerge was this sense of, you know, I don't think I have anybody who is a millennial that I actually know who doesn't either work with me, work for me, my children or friends of my children. Right. I thought, I don't think that's right. Now, I have no idea why that thought would have come into my head. But it was like, well, I think I need to, there's some things I can learn here. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of a naturally inquisitive person. So I ran across a group in Indianapolis called Edge Mentoring, which focuses on this engagement. So in my case, I have 9 young men and we have a regular schedule of conversations. But what's emerged out of that now, a couple of years down the road, is we've become friends. We actually do things together as friends. But if I back away from that, and then that took me into conversations with people like Telemachus Network, it's similar but a different format. Praxis Labs, similar but different format. But the thing that is in common across all of them was this notion of intergenerational friendships are a really good thing. And that got me to thinking about two elements. One is, why intergenerational? And I realized that was a direct link to something that I do in Monon Capital, which is in this thought and conversation studio. And it'll seem kind of odd, but we do things that are really around re-engaging people's ability to learn through metaphor and analogy. That oftentimes when things present themselves as a problem, we think it's new.
Right.
Oftentimes, those problems actually aren't new. They're just new to me. And they may not actually have a solution set in my domain.
Right.
But they could be solved in a different domain.
Right.
So I have this whole concept around orthogonal learning we can talk about at some point. But essentially, what intergenerational is, it's the same thing of saying it's not that we can talk about all of our experiences in their specifics, but they are analogies to what you can be experiencing in your phase of life right now. So that's why I can look at it easily and say, the guys who are 26, I learn a lot from, because the questions they're posing show up as similar questions that I have, even though I'm older.
Right.
And even though I've had more experience. So it's not a one-way street. It's at least a two-way street, or in this case, because there's 10 of us in total, it's like a huge roundabout.
Right.
So that's the intergenerational piece becomes a way to continually grow my learning and doing it through metaphor and analogy of what is it somebody's saying and how can I think about that as a context for something that I'm experiencing and what can I learn from it?
Right.
The second part is there's just a sheer amount of energy. It's, you know, there are times when I can look at it and go, I can remember my career easily when I loved running as hard and fast as I can.
Right.
And I learned over time that pace actually matters. So people would use all these concepts of, you know, life is a marathon, it's not a sprint, on and on and on. And I thought, yeah, I hear what you're saying, but it seems kind of trite to me. Yeah, you know, that I like full speed.
Right. I can attest to that.
I discovered that full speed often doesn't give you the time to put in the thoughtfulness that you need to actually have moments of contemplation and consideration. And I'll give you one more element of this. One of the things that I've observed is that the answer to almost every question when we have, when we're not doing well, is we need to execute better. Hmm. And one of the things that I've come to a conclusion of is that's often true, but it presupposes that we actually have a really good idea.
Right.
And since time is somewhat limited in that way, all the time you spend in executing, and if the question simply becomes one of how do we execute, when do we ever stand back and ask ourselves, was this the best idea we could have possibly had?
Mm-hmm.
So when people make the statement broadly then that says, you know what, a good idea executed outstanding is okay. Maybe even a mediocre idea executed well is really good. And I just look at people and go, I want you to say what you just said out loud again, because I'm not sure that you would think that that's all that rational.
Right.
So you're willing to live with a very mediocre idea and just execute it very well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I said, what if we took time to say, what if we came up with a better idea? So if I said to you, I'd like to have a really good idea and execute it in a mediocre way, do you think that's the equivalent of the other model? No. I said, okay, well, I don't know that either, but I can just tell you that having a better idea is usually a better idea.
Right.
So what if we focused on having equal amount of time between focusing on executing better and having better ideas? So that's how those things come together for me. And a lot of that comes in this intergenerational space that you see people who have new thoughtful ideas, and you have people who go, actually, I know how to execute that in a way that's foreign to you because you haven't seen this movie yet.
Right.
But equally, the movie doesn't always end the same way.
Right.
So
that's really interesting. So I guess thinking about some of these intergenerational friendships you've developed, these, you know, like the Edge Network, is it Telemachus Networks?
Yeah.
You know, these types of groups, do you find yourself in that group kind of playing the mentor role? Or is it really kind of a friendship where it's give and take on both sides pretty evenly?
I think it evolves. So, and this is very much of a developing thought on my part, is that I think there's actually a continuum in here that you can have relationships that are very much one that are almost coaching in the sense mm-hmm. of, I need to learn this and you know how to do this. Will you teach me?
Right.
And then you have a mentoring thing, which I think expands that, in which there is a broader width of conversations. So it's not just about the specific task. It's actually about, it might be centered in the task, but it gets into natural things. So people will say, we'll have a conversation around doing a financial model for a particular transaction. And next thing, you know, somebody will say is, and I'm getting a little bit of feedback that I'm not very present at home even when I'm there, because I'm always on my computer doing the analysis. And my wife is saying, I would actually like to enjoy your company other than you physically just sitting next to me.
Right.
And then the friendship piece comes when those conversations become less foundational in the task and more foundational around a give and take relationship. So as you can tell, this is really forming in my mind, but I do think it's a continuum. I don't think that the goal is to turn everything into a friendship.
Right.
I think but discerning what it is about where we are in mm-hmm. our conversation matters. And then in effect, it becomes one of, well, let's see what it looks like if it goes to the next one. In my mind, I try to be a little bit more intentional about testing. Is the next stage in this reasonable and right for both of us.
Right.
So you have to kind of lean into that, whereas I don't think most people are particularly attuned to, it just kind of is what it is, which I think actually doesn't lead to friendships.
Right.
So now if I back up a stage, one of the things, conversation that we've had within our Edge Mentoring call a couple months ago, one of the guys said, so of all the things that we've talked about, what's the one thing, if you could wave your magic wand, you would give us for where we are in our stage of life? And again, in a, I think in an actually very providential way, the words that came out were, I would give you the gift of a 40-year friendship, because I have one of those. People that we met a long time ago, we lived in England together, and yet over these years, when we get back together, it's as if we've never been apart, even though we see each other about once a year. So the problem with a 40-year friendship, though, is that there's no way to get there without 40 years.
Right.
So that one of the things I would encourage you to do is begin to nurture things that you can see this moving into a long friendship. And when that begins to happen, to cultivate that. So I'm trying to use the word cultivate carefully here, because it's like, you want to nurture that, but you don't want to push it. You know, friendship is an amazing dynamic, because it's so, it requires an equanimity, but yet at other times it's very asymmetrical, you know, that people, things go on in people's lives. So, and I actually don't know how many, you know, how many friendships can you really have? I don't know, but that's not, I wouldn't start with a quantitative number of saying, well, I need to have six.
Right.
I have no idea how many I can manage, but I just know that if the answer is zero, that's a bad outcome. So right. I start there.
That's really interesting, because I love the idea of you viewing it as a continuum, right? So it starts around a task, or it starts around something that somebody's trying to accomplish, maybe in their business or an entrepreneurial venture or something like that. But then it leads itself into that that friendship. I actually had a friend in high school who you said something really interesting to me, and it always stuck with me in this. It was this idea of friendship, because we originally made a connection because I was in a band at the time in high school, and he was in a band at the time in high school, and we ended up kind of playing some shows together around the local area. And we would end up having these longer conversations outside of music, outside of, you know, the band space and that type of stuff on, at the time it was like ICQ or one of these kind of like early 2000s, you know, messaging tools that existed. And at one point he just said, you know, this is really cool. He said, I heard somebody say, he was quoting somebody that, you know, if you've really found a good friend, you can talk about stuff outside of what originally connected you. And so it was this idea that we weren't friends just because we were in a band that was in the same geographic area. We weren't friends because we both played the guitar. We weren't friends because we just liked the same type of music. We were friends initially because of that, but then it turned into lots of other conversations and lots of other reasons why we wanted to continue that relationship. And so that really stuck out to me at that time. And it sounds like you're echoing the same thing, but you're starting these conversations almost in a business context. Is that fair to say?
They often start there, but that's meaning that might be the animating force. But the very first conversation usually reveals that that was only the reason that it came together.
Right. Very surface level at that point.
My framework has really been informed over the last year of rereading C.S. Lewis's Four Loves. And in there, he has a quote that has been burned into my mind, even though I've read it hundreds of times. It finally came to reality over the last 2 years as I've been in this exploration, I guess, of this whole intergenerational friendship piece. And it's that he says, a friendship begins when one person says to another, what, you two? I thought I was the only one.
Wow.
And for me, what that does is connect a lot of the dots about how do friendships develop over time. Now, if I take that specific and I go back, one of the coolest things to read is a book by Joe LaConte. He wrote a book called Hobbit, A Wardrobe and the Great War. The friendship of C.S. Lewis and Tolkien.
Okay.
And he unpacks that in a great way to say, how did these two people become friends and march through life together? But their shared point was experiences in World War I, which shaped their view about how they thought about people and leadership, and that was very optimistic but realistic, very much in a forward way, where almost all other writers of that era, whether it be Hemingway to Eliot, all came out with, at best, a skeptical, largely tilted to cynical view. So how did that friendship enable them to come to a point in which they could advance conversations rather than kind of, this is an extreme, but kind of wallowing in the misery of all of life as we had projected it in our modernist thinking has come to an end. And you get this, right, you know, generations of people who kind of practiced on their best day, you could call it lament, which it was a, I think it was a very accurate description of what was going on, but it actually didn't lead to very much of a forward thinking about, okay, now what do we do?
Right.
It led to a lot of introspection. So all of that comes back to Lewis, for me, has been an animating force then in this conversation, where that phrase of "what you two, I thought I was the only one" is where that turns out to be the thing that pulls a lot of these friendships together.
Right.
I just don't know what the "you two" part is. That's what, that's the fun part in the conversation. Like,
right,
you know, ours about, you know, we're sitting there talking about, I wonder what it looks like to have a, an automation driven home. And we're generationally different.
Right.
But yet the questions we have are the same, which I find to be fascinating.
Right. Well, that it's, that is a, you actually brought back a thought that I was having when you were, you're talking about some of these intergenerational, friendships. And even what I look at is the gap between some of the generations as a whole that a lot of people talk about. And, you know, I think one of the number one things, you know, bringing this kind of full circle, that I see people looking at millennials and saying they're selfish, is because they don't just want to spend 25 years making money and having that be the primary focus and then having significance. They want to have significance right away. And that seems to be one of the biggest divides that I hear in conversations. And it might be because it's something that's important to me, but I look at a lot of baby boomers who say, well, no, you have to put in your dues for 25, 30 years and retire and then have significance. And millennials are saying, that doesn't make sense to me. Why would I spend a quarter of my life, you know, a third of my life not being significant or not caring about what I love and not doing something around what I love, and then finally get to do it, you know, for 10 years, maybe before I die or something like that,
you know?
And so again, it gets back to you, that we're asking the same questions at different times with different experiences and, you know, in a different context, right? Because the world was very different 25, 30 years ago, you know, versus what it's like now. And so
I think one of the things that's in that, and I can speak to this, you know, from the boomer generation perspective, is that we have this idea that we've compartmentalized into that, okay, I've got success and I've got significance. The problem with that is it's actually, not only is it not true, it's absolutely not true. Meaning that you are having a whole lot of significance along the way because you are constantly shaping experiences for other people that shaped either their view of themselves, their view in the world, their view of you, your view in the world. The problem with that is that if you don't pay attention and you don't do it with an intentionality, you end up with an outcome where you kind of go, well, this is like random activity. So you get drawn at some point to say, I don't think it's a draw to significance. I think it's a draw to the dawning realization that I don't think I've had the impact. And I tell people that is not true.
Yeah.
That is not true at all. You've had enormous impact. What you don't understand is what is that impact you've been having on other people, and you are anxious that it's not been what you would want, have it want, what you want it to be, had you had a thoughtful, intentional perspective about it.
Right.
That's the difference. On the millennial side, I think it's exactly the same issues. People can say, I want what you described, but yet the challenge becomes one of, how do I make this so that it's, I'm really trying to do this because I'm trying to make it about other people. This isn't just, I want to be significant because it makes me feel better.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not a bad thing.
Right.
But trying to make an impact and living purposefully when it's really serving your own goal is no different than the boomer piece. It's the same disease. It
right.
just has different symptoms mm-hmm. at a different point. Both of them don't lead to a good outcome. So, you know, in my conversations with, I'll say the Gen Xers in particular and the millennials, my only question to them is, I think your perception of boomers is correct. The key question is, what's going to be the failing of your generation? And can you see the insight now that say, I actually want to change the trajectory so that I don't have the equivalent of success to significance conversation with right. myself. I'm 60. How do you live in a faithful, purposeful, engaging way earlier? Because
mm-hmm.
that's actually what I think the success to significant thing gets to.
Yeah. And I guess I see it in a lot of the people that I interact with. There are a lot of millennials who want to, you know, and so I love this idea that you have of these, again, these intergenerational friendships, because, you know, mentoring doesn't always have to look like mentoring. It can just be a friendship. It can just be having these conversations. And I think there's two camps in this in the millennial space, which is one is, you know, well, those older generations, the baby boomers, the best generation, all those people, like we can look at the years that they've had to kind of be the primary generation and be in power and have leadership and all this type of stuff. And we naturally focus on what did they mess up and what are they looking at us and don't like and stuff like that. Instead of saying, you know, hey, once we have 50, 60 years to be a generation, we're going to have gotten things wrong too. And so how do we actually have these conversations with people who have been around that long, who have had these opportunities to fail and succeed? And like you said, how do we avoid what our generation's, you know, staple of failure was going to look like?
Yes.
Right. You know, what is that going to look like for people who are like my age down to like, you know, 24 to 35, right? What's Gen X going to say, you know, or what is the, you know, Gen Z going to look at Gen X and say, you know, man, you guys got it so wrong. You know, what was wrong with you? How can we look at that as an introspection for our generation? Say, how do we then communicate with people who have been there, who have done that, who have that experience, and see how can we avoid that? Right. Or at least for myself, right. How do I avoid that as somebody in this generation? So it's a really interesting concept.
You know, there's in my Edge call this week, we were actually talking about an interview that occurred between Ken Myers of Mars Hill Audio and Susan Cain, not too long after she'd written her book on quiet and extroverts or introverts in a world that can't stop talking. And she made a very interesting point that everybody picked up on. And she said, in the turn of the 20th century, we had a culture of character.
Hmm.
And that's what people talked about.
Right.
You were describing somebody, you would describe them in terms of their character, and people aspired to being seen as people of character. From that point forward, we have largely been in a world of the cult of personality.
Right.
Which this whole conversation around, and you know, the implications of that about extroverts and introverts, and I think it more in terms of the expressiveness of people, but really a way to make it difficult for folks who have a more contemplative approach to actually have an equivalent seat at the table, if you will. Mm-hmm. But the question we talked about is, are we in a transition to something else? Hmm. And interestingly, so this is a group of folks who are between 24 and 32. We had a couple of comments that came out. One is, you know, I can see we're moving to a cult of success.
Right.
That we can, personality is not as important, character is not as important, that the key marker is one of, are you successful? Mm-hmm. And that's almost always in a financial sense.
Right.
somebody else said, maybe it's we're seeing this rise of a culture of power, right, that if you can exert power, that that's the desired outcome. So bringing our conversation together here, I think the question for whether it be the Gen Xers, the millennials, is what part of this transition from a culture of something to something, mm-hmm, are we naturally, is it the water that we're in? It's the air that we all breathe. That right. It's so much around us. We don't even understand how it's shaping our view. If I were to vote, I would like to say, I don't want to go back in history to the culture of character by having the same behavioral patterns there, but I right. think having a culture of character is actually better than a culture of personality, and is way better than having a culture of success or power, in my opinion. Now, that doesn't mean it didn't have all kinds of warts to it, and its right. expression in society was uneven, mm-hmm, or disconnected from the reality of what was happening. But I think David Brooks gets this in his talks around virtue and character. And it's one of the reasons why I have great hope going forward, because people see that as an anchoring element that they can go back to, as opposed to the more ephemeral nature of personality or success or power, that those, there's a lot of things that go on in that are actually outside of your control.
Right.
Whose character is not.
It's interesting. Well, we're getting pretty close on our time here, and I don't want to keep you longer than I promised. So any closing remarks, any last thoughts you have?
I think I would probably just really encourage people to lean into the friendships that they have and say, what do I need to be putting into this to ensure that these friendships are lasting over time? And oftentimes that means, I have one right now where I have to be able to say to the person, there are some things that you're doing right now that I got to tell you, I'm not happy about, but you're probably not going to be able to do something that's going to make me actually go away.
Right.
Now you may tell me to go away, but that doesn't make me go away. So I think one of the markers in a friendship and an intergenerational friendship ultimately turns out to be, there's much more of, it's short of a covenant type relationship, but it's just shy of that. It's okay. I don't know that I can say come anything, I'm here, but I think it needs to approach that. And I think that gives people in a friendship a sense of comfort that you can be more transparent, because you probably can't do something that's going to make me go away.
Right.
But when you make that commitment, I don't think most of us understand what happens, what could possibly happen, where all of a sudden I just got sucked into something that's really not good. So I think the other part is, man, be more intentional about creating these intergenerational friendships. It is remarkably engaging and energizing and joy filled. So I would do those two things.
That's great. Well, thank you again. I really appreciate you being on the show.
You're welcome, Josh.
It's been awesome. It went in some directions I never anticipated, and that was probably better than what I could have planned. So That's awesome.
You're most welcome.
All right. Well, thank you, Doug. Real quick, actually, one last thing before we go. Is there any places you would want people to reach out to you or find you, maybe on social media or anything like that?
Certainly. My LinkedIn profile is out there, so look for that as Doug Wilson. A second one is I have a Facebook page, which is generally oriented around the things that I'm interested in. Mm-hmm. I put a few personal things out there, but generally it's more the things that I read and I enjoy those. And it's really just a way for me to say, here's what I'm reading. If you're interested, have at it type thing.
Okay.
So those are the two.
All right. Well, again, thank you. I really appreciate it. And I'm sure we'll be talking on the show again.
Great. Thanks, Josh.
As always, I would love to hear from you. If you're listening to this on Anchor, you can give me a call in or leave me a comment. If you're listening to it anywhere else, you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram under I'm Josh Newton.
And if you're enjoying the show and you haven't already, go to your favorite podcast listening app and subscribe and leave me a review. You can give me 5 stars, 4 stars, whatever you think I deserve. But the more reviews that we get, the easier it'll be for other people to find this content and be able to put their potential into practice.